Hello, med students. This is Zach Olson. Procrastinator's Guide to Emergency Medicine is up and running. If you are going into emergency medicine and need your rotation to go well, remember, you never get a second chance to make a great first impression. And that is what this course is designed to do. Help you make a great first impression by giving you 3 hours of high-yield content curated and designed so that you are ready for your first shift. You can go to our website, www.emclerkship.com, and there is a link in the top menu, or you can go to courses.emclerkship.com and sign up there as well. Now enjoy the show.
Hello, residents. My name is Mike Estefan. I'm joined by Maddie Watts, and thank you for downloading this month's episode of the EM Clerkship Podcast. This episode is sponsored by Pearson Ravitz Insurance, my personal independent disability insurance agent. We will talk more about Pearson Ravitz later in the episode. But for now, let's get right into it. Maddie Watts, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How about you, Mike?
I am fantastic. I'm very jet lagged from an international trip, switching over to nights, but I am surviving. I can't complain. Today is round number 10 of the game. I believe it's round number 10. Yeah. Maddie will need to perform today's case in real ABEM oral boards format. She has 15 minutes to complete the full case. She does not know what this case is ahead of time. If Maddie hits all of the critical actions that I've listed out beforehand, she wins. And if she doesn't, or if she performs one of the many dangerous actions in this case, I win. These cases were created by me. They are not derived from actual ABEM cases that I had, and they are not real patients. Maddie, please take out a piece of paper and a pencil. Place the paper sideways in front of you and outline a human body on the left side of it, and let me know when you are ready.
I'm ready to go.
All right, Dr. Watts, this will be a single patient encounter, and you will have 15 minutes to complete the case. Before we begin, do you have any questions?
Nope.
All right. And let's begin. The timer started. You are working at Clerkship General when you hear an EMS call on the base command radio. Clerkship General, we are bringing you an agitated and combative 30-year-old male. We'll see you in 5 minutes. Maddie, is there anything you would like to do to prepare?
Do I have any vital signs from EMS?
They were not able to get vital signs because of the agitation.
All right. So I would definitely like some staff on hand to back me up, some nursing staff. If we have some security officers, that would be great. I would probably like to have some meds ready, but I really don't know what I'm going to get with this agitated patient, so I'll probably just see what rolls in the door.
Okay. And EMS has arrived. Hey, Doc. This is Greg. He's a 30-year-old male, very well known to us. Greg really likes his cocaine. He used cocaine today, like he usually does. We got a call, though, that he was creating a scene on the street, so we had to take him in. On the way here, we had to restrain him for our own safety. And the charge nurse chimes in, Greg, again? This is the third time this week.
So when I walk in the room, what do I see?
You see a diaphoretic young male in the EMS stretcher fighting his restraints.
Okay. Can I see pupil findings or skin findings?
Shut up! You're all worthless! You can't even get close to him. He's trying to swing. You can't get an exam on him at all right now.
Okay. Do we know if patient has any medication allergies from his many visits?
You check the EMR, no known drug allergies.
Okay. So if patient is still fighting my staff, I want to keep my staff safe. So I think we need to give some IM injections. Let's do 5 of droperidol and 5 of Versed IM.
Okay. 5 of droperidol and 5 of Versed IM have been administered. And fast forward a few minutes and patient is calming down.
Okay. Is he still trying to swing at staff?
No, he is not.
Okay. So I don't think we need to put him in restraints right now, but I want to watch him closely. If we can try to get an opening set of vitals now that he's a little more calm, that would also be helpful.
Sure. The nurse is taking vital signs. Heart rate of 134, respiratory rate of 22, blood pressure of 192 over 105, O2 saturation of 99% on room air.
All right. So he's tachycardic and hypertensive. We know he has history of cocaine use, so he's probably got some sympathomimetic toxicity right now. Greg, I'm Dr. Watts. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Are you hurting anywhere right now?
No.
Okay. Do you have any headache?
No.
Do you have any chest pain?
No.
Do you have any shortness of breath?
No.
Okay. What happened today?
He didn't respond. He's pretty out of it.
Okay. So, does he have any external signs of trauma on exam? Any hematoma or bruising, obvious deformities to the long bones?
You see no obvious signs of trauma.
Okay. When I listen to his heart and lungs, what do I hear?
Lungs are clear throughout. Heart, no obvious murmur. He's tachycardic, but otherwise, S1, S2 present.
Okay. Is his abdomen soft and non-tender?
Abdomen is soft and non-tender, correct.
Okay. When I look at his extremities, is his skin wet or dry?
His skin is moist.
Okay. And you said no signs of trauma. Compartments are soft.
Correct.
Okay. What are his pupils?
His pupils are dilated.
Okay. All right. So all of this fits so far with sympathomimetic toxicity. I'm going to give him a little bit of time to metabolize the medications that we gave him here, and then keep him on the monitor if he'll tolerate it.
Okay. Patient is placed on the cardiac monitor.
Okay. While he's on the monitor, can we get an EKG?
Okay. We can do an EKG. Doc, are there any other tests you want now?
Yeah, if he's calm enough to have us obtain IV access, I'd like to get IV access in case we need it later.
Okay, what do you want?
Let's just try to get a peripheral IV. It can be ideally 18 or 20 gauge, and then let's start a liter of fluids as well.
Okay, Doc, do you want any labs while I'm placing the line?
Sure. We can send off a CBC, a BMP, and let's just start with that for right now.
Okay. CBC and a BMP have been drawn off the line, an 18 gauge.
And a CK, actually. Let me add on a CK because he was agitated and fighting.
And a CK. Okay, got it. An 18 gauge was placed, 1 liter bolus is being administered, and EKG was sent to you.
Okay. Let's take a look at this EKG. So I see a narrow complex tachycardia. Looks like it's about 150 beats per minute. I'm looking for P waves. And it looks like I have P waves, so I believe this is a sinus tachycardia. I don't see any obvious ST segment, depression, or elevation, so I don't think I need to be worried about drug-induced ischemia. So I think we are good from that perspective. So I'm going to give him some time to metabolize and then reassess.
Okay. And your labs have already begun to start to trickle in. You have your CBC with a white blood cell count of 7.4, a hemoglobin of 14.5, and a platelet count of 450. Your BMP has a sodium of 135, a chloride of 107, a potassium of 5.9, a bicarb of 18, a creatinine of 3.15, a BUN of 49, a glucose of 105, and his CK came back at 10,500.
All right, so he's definitely got an AKI or some pretty bad CKD. But given that his CK is through the roof, I think he's got rhabdo, and that's causing his potassium to be 5.9, which I don't love. His EKG didn't have peaked T waves, so I don't think I need to give him calcium. But I would like to try to do some shifting of that potassium. Let's hang another liter of fluids. We can do LR or normal saline, whatever we have available. Let's start some albuterol via face mask, and then we will give some insulin and dextrose as well. Is he still relatively sedated?
The nurse actually went in to hang the second leader and start those medications, and she calls you back into the room. Hey, doc, he looks a little different than he was earlier. I don't know what's going on.
All right, so I walk back in the room, and what do I see?
You see, again, a diaphoretic young male who seemingly isn't doing much. Doc, I can't wake him up, at least before I was able to wake him up, but he's not waking up.
All right, do we have a pulse?
You have a pulse.
Okay.
He is on the monitor, sinus tach at 130s.
Okay. If I try to sternal rub him, does he show any reaction, moaning, moving?
He doesn't respond to sternal rub.
Okay. What are his pupils currently?
They're still equal and dilated, but his eyes aren't opening.
Okay. Are they reactive?
They are sluggish.
Okay. And how large are they?
Let's say 3.5 millimeters.
Okay. And he does not respond when I pinch any of his extremities.
The only thing he does is moan incomprehensibly.
Okay. So he's not reliably moving his extremities. He's had an acute change in his mental status, and he has dilated pupils. So I am concerned that he could have intracranial hemorrhage from cocaine use, so I would like to take him to the CT scan for non-contrast head CT. Is he currently maintaining his saturations and breathing without any intervention?
Yeah, he is breathing, but he is obtunded.
Okay. So given that his eyes aren't opening and he's moaning to pain, and I guess, is he withdrawing at all or just moaning?
Just moaning. He's not moving.
Okay. So unfortunately, I think I will need to intubate this patient before going to the CT scanner due to his depressed mental status. I don't want him to lose his airway in the CT scanner. So given that he's got rhabdo, I don't want to use succinylcholine, so we'll use rocuronium. And then for his induction agent, I don't really want to use ketamine because I don't want to raise his blood pressure, so I'll use etomidate. What was our most recent blood pressure?
You recheck it, and it is now 210 over 105.
Okay. So let's prepare to intubate. I would like to start pre-oxygenating him with a non-rebreather, have him on the monitor, which I believe he already is, And then if we can prepare Atomidate and Rock-Uronium. I know Atomidate, or I know Rock-Uronium is 0.6 to 1 mg per kg. I can't remember the dosing of Atomidate off the top of my head because I usually use ketamine. But let's go ahead and prepare our agents for induction paralysis while we're pre-oxygenating him.
Okay, you intubated him successfully. Okay. Got equal breath sounds, good color change, end tidal is capturing.
Okay. Let's get a chest x-ray to confirm, and then let's roll to the CT scan as soon as possible for non-con head CT.
All right, chest x-ray has just been sent over, and you wheel him off to CT. And you're looking through the images, and this is the first thing you see.
All right, so his ET tube looks appropriately placed about 4 to 5 centimeters over the carina, and he's got inflated lungs bilaterally, and he has a very large intracranial hemorrhage. It looks like it's in the like occipital temporal area. When we get back, I would like to lower his blood pressure, and talk to neurosurgery.
Okay. How would you like to lower his blood pressure?
Let's give him, 20 of labetalol.
Okay.
20. Actually, yeah, let's give that. And then he probably needs to be on a cardine drip to get him a lot lower. What is his most recent blood pressure?
After the 20 of labetalol, he is down to 180 over 100, heart rate of 100.
Okay. So we've got room in the heart rate. Let's start him on a cardine drip, and let's try to target a blood pressure of less than 150 over 110. And then can I page neurosurgery for intracranial hemorrhage?
You do not have neurosurgery at your shop.
Oh, gosh. So I would like to go ahead and put in a transfer request to the nearest center that does have neurosurgery and neuro ICU.
Great. Patient was accepted and the helicopter is on its way. Is there anything else you would like to do?
Can we confirm in the chart that he's not on any anticoagulants?
Yeah, you check the EMR. He is not on any medications at this time.
Okay. And so we have our blood pressure management. He's not hypoxic. Do we have a temperature?
We can check a temperature.
That would be great. Probably should have done that a while ago.
His temperature is 98.8.
Oh, thank God. Okay. and then what's our most recent blood pressure?
Let's say the cardine drip has been titrated and he is at 145 over 100.
Okay. And then we should probably start some sedation for him. What's our neuro exam currently?
He's GCS3T right now.
Okay. So we can do some sedation with propofol if to continue our sedation. And then, let's see. What am I missing? I think that's everything.
Okay. And that ends your case. Woo! A minute over. I kind of let that drag on a little bit.
I know. I had a hunch. I had a hunch you were letting it go.
No, you did good. Before we go through exactly how you did, let's talk about our sponsor for the month, Pearson Ravitz Insurance. Pearson Ravitz is my personal disability insurance broker. When shopping for disability insurance, the keyword is own occupation disability insurance. It is important to obtain an own occupation disability insurance policy early on in your training for multiple reasons. First of all, there is a steep discounted rate for residents, and this rate will follow you into attendinghood like it did for me. And while you may feel healthy now, it is still very possible that you will become disabled while in residency. So why wait? Second of all, most people will never be healthier through the rest of their life than they are today. Don't wait until you develop medical problems, as the insurance companies will often put in exclusion clauses for disability due to pre-existing conditions. Pearson Rabbits will work with you to find the best policy for your specific needs and will break it down into plain English that you can understand. Don't wait until it's too late. Check out Pearson Rabbits at www.pearsonrabbits.com and schedule a consultation with Stephanie Pearson or one of her team members today. Now, back to the episode. So, Maddie, what is your overall interpretation of this case? I mean, like, what happened? What was the final diagnosis?
This patient had a hypertensive intracranial hemorrhage secondary to likely cocaine or other sympathomimetic use.
And rhabdo. 100% agree with you. And how do you think you did?
I think I did pretty well. I definitely think it can be hard on these oral cases and in real life when you have somebody who comes in distress, whether it's medical distress or they're agitated, and you kind of skip to the management part of your assessment and plan, and then you kind of have to go back to your physical exam later, go back to your history later. And so sometimes things can get forgotten, like the temperature. So I guess I was kind of lucky that that was not elevated, that he didn't have some thyrotoxicosis or medication side effect or something like that. So definitely remembering to go back. But I think I did pretty well, and I circled back pretty well.
Yeah, no, I agree. You did really well. And I think getting that CK early on was a game changer here. Let's go through the critical actions, and then we can talk a little more about the case. So my five critical actions were: number one, administer sedation for the safety of the patient and the staff, which you did promptly. Number two was intubate the patient once he becomes obtunded and obtained a post-intubation chest x-ray, which you did. Good job. Number three was diagnose an intracranial hemorrhage following the change of mental status, which you did. Number four was treat the patient's hypertension with a goal systolic of around 140-ish. There's really not good data for a specific number. It's really institutionally dependent. My hospital, we aim for less than 140, but whatever you said, I think it was 150 over 100 or whatever, it was totally fine. And number five, diagnose the cause of the patient's renal failure, which was rhabdo, and administer the treatment, which is copious amounts of IV fluids, which you did. So you not only passed this case, you passed with essentially flying colors. There were a few dangerous actions weaved into this case, and there is a controversial one that I'm going to talk about that you definitely wouldn't fail the case for doing this in my eyes, but in the board's eyes, potentially. So, dangerous actions: not sedating the patient when he arrived agitated. That's dangerous for the staff, dangerous for the patient themselves. So you did a good job there. If you didn't intubate this patient with the mental status change, he would have vomited and aspirated and maybe coded, depending how nice I was feeling. Not controlling the blood pressure, he would have blown a pupil and herniated and definitely coded. If you gave succinylcholine in the setting of this hyper-K, he would have went into a V-fib arrest from worsening hyper-K. So good job picking up on that. And then the last thing, which we should talk about a little bit, is giving labetalol in this particular circumstance, meaning in the setting of cocaine intoxication. So I'm sure you remember from med school the old adage of never give a beta blocker to somebody who's coming in with cocaine intoxication. And why is that? That adage, why does that exist?
Yeah, so I do remember this, and then I remember learning that it's not always true. So this is probably the controversial thing, but in the case of labetalol, you'd be blunting both the alpha and beta response, but now I'm trying to remember the actual pathophysiology of it all.
No, it's pretty complicated. The old saying is never beta block somebody with cocaine intoxication because you end up causing unopposed alpha. Because most beta blockers are pretty nonspecific. You'll get beta 1 and beta 2 blockage, and beta 2 is a vasodilator. So by blocking beta 2 receptors, you allow the cocaine to essentially activate all the alpha receptors without any negative feedback, and you get unopposed alpha activity. So that's the old adage, and that can lead to worsening vasospasm, worsening hypertension, et cetera, et cetera. The thing with labetalol is it actually has some alpha blocking activity. It's very nonspecific, though the beta blocking activity is much stronger than its alpha blocking activity. What I would say, I did a little research into this preparing for the case, and recent studies have showed that labetalol is completely fine in cocaine intoxication. But to be fair, the boards tend to be old school. I don't know if you've had your in-service exam yet, but some of the questions on there are super old school. And for the purpose of the boards, I would personally not give any beta blocker in the setting of cocaine intoxication, just on the off chance they are not up to date with the most recent evidence.
Got it.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, but 100% real life, I think this was totally fine. But for some graders on the boards might have an issue beta blocking in the setting of cocaine intoxication. But I certainly would not fault you for doing so.
Okay, that makes sense. And yeah, as soon as I did that, I didn't actually hesitate because of that. I kind of forgot about that, but was thinking that it'd probably be easier to do a drip and titrate because this person's going to need a lot of blood pressure control. But that's definitely a really good thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, no, and in real life, the only time I really use labetalol for hypertension is if I have somebody I'm going to give TPA to and their blood pressure is outside of the TPA guidelines. So just because it's so quick and easy and I can push it while the patient is on the CT scanner. But for somebody with uncontrolled hypertension, like hypertensive emergency, I just start a cardine or a clavidipine drip immediately. I personally really like clavidipine because it's like the Esmolol of calcium channel blockers. It's quick on, quick off. If you overshoot it, you can rapidly change your dose, and you'll see those physiologic changes really quickly, kind of like Esmolol. But I know not all centers use clavidipine, so cardine is also pretty common.
Yeah, we don't have clavidipine, or at least not in down in the ED at my center.
Otherwise, I think you did really, really good. You rocked this case. I think it would have been a little harder for you if you had not ordered that CK up front, because you'd have somebody with essentially new onset renal failure without an obvious etiology. And what I was hoping would happen, I was hoping you were going to order a CMP and not a BMP, because on the CMP, his AST was going to be like 1,000, but his ALT was going to be normal. And when you see that, an essentially normal ALT with a super elevated AST, you have to think about rhabdo, because AST is also present in muscle cells. It's a very nonspecific enzyme. So when people have muscle breakdown, they'll have an elevated AST as well as an elevated CK.
Okay. Good to know.
Other than that, if you had gotten a urinalysis on him, I would have shown the classic findings for rhabdo. And do you know what those are on urinalysis?
Yeah, so you have myoglobinuria. So you will have the positive heme on the urine dipstick, but you won't have red blood cells on the microscopic.
Exactly. Yeah. You were going to have +3 protein, +3 blood on the dip, but then the micro would come back with like 0 RBCs essentially. And that's pretty pathognomonic. At least my understanding is it's pathognomonic for myoglobinuria. Bless you.
Thank you.
Other than that, do you have any other questions or comments about the case?
I don't think so, though. I think it would be interesting to do some discussion about preferred agents for agitation, because I think we've talked about that on the podcast before, but it's something that we see so commonly in the ED. And I remember when I was a little baby intern, being so scared of, you know, when the nurse runs to you and they're like, what do you need? I need something right now. And you're like, And so ever since Droperidol's been back, I've used a lot of that and found that a lot of my attendings that were around for the first round of Droperidol really like it. And doing some Versed for sort of the more long-lasting effect and the benzos for his sympathomimetic toxicity. But I do think having kind of an idea of what your go-to agitation agents is good to have in the back pocket.
So to our listeners, I swear this wasn't planned. This Maddie had no idea that question was asked. It was coming, and her answer was totally unplanned. The deep dive this month is going to be on exactly that. My approach personally to the agitated patient and the different choices of agents and why some are essentially objectively better than others. But we'll talk about that more on the deep dive.
Awesome. I will definitely be listening.
Other than that, yeah, you mentioned when you were a little baby intern. Are you ready to be a big bad second year? It's coming up.
A baby second year.
30 years or 30 days.
Yeah, it's wild. Baby second year. I mean, I think everyone feels this way. The more you learn, the more you feel like you know absolutely nothing. So it doesn't feel like I'm ready to be a second year. But then when I look back at how I felt and what I could do at the beginning of the year, I feel like I definitely have come a long way. But yeah, still a little scared for becoming a second year, because that's kind of when everything really ramps up at my program and you take kind of the responsibility of moving the department and seeing all the trauma, seeing all the medical resus patients. So I'm excited, but also definitely still nervous.
The biggest, I guess, hurdle for me being a second year was, on top of all those other new responsibilities you have clinically being a second year, which in and of itself is terrifying. But you also have the responsibility of making sure your baby interns aren't killing people and are, you know, doing well, right? Yeah. Like, so you're looking out for yourself in this new responsibility, but you're also looking out for your oncoming class. And I honestly think second year is the most stressful part of residency, especially at the beginning for emergency medicine residency, because you're juggling those two acts. As a third year, at least you have a year of experience, you know, doing the resuscitations and that kind of stuff. And the teaching of the interns becomes much more fun and less stressful.
Yeah, I have a whole new respect for our current class of second years, because when I first came in as an intern, they seemed so confident. And now knowing how they felt then, I was like, oh my gosh, they played it off so cool and collected and were like telling me the ins and outs of how to admit to XYZ service when they had like 12 trauma patients that they were carrying. But yes, you got to pass it forward and take care of your new interns, because we've all been there, and there's nothing more terrifying than shift one, day one, when you're like, okay, here we go.
Here's some Tylenol. Am I going to kill this patient's liver?
Yeah. Can I order this? Are we sure? Are we positive?
Do we need to check liver function tests before I order the Tylenol?
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, good times. Well, that's all I have for you guys today, and I just want to put a quick plug in here. If you haven't already heard, Zach and I created an awesome video course designed specifically to prepare you for your day one of your emergency medicine clerkship. It literally has everything I wish I knew before my first rotation in emergency medicine, and it's condensed into 3 hours of video content that you can watch quite literally the night before your clerkship starts. Now, it is a paid course, but I promise you it is worth every dollar. Zach and I poured our hearts into this, and it is literally designed to elevate you from a pass or a high pass student to an honor student. There will be a link in the show notes to where you can find out more and purchase this course if interested. And as always, if you have any questions about this episode or about the course, send us emails. Zach@emclerkship.com, Mike@emclerkship.com, and Maddie@emclerkship.com. And until next time, keep working hard, keep studying, and be sure to enjoy your shift.